Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Vestai Vampyr and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to the Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn. And today we have with us...
I'm Kitari Bikandido, author of lots and lots of books and stories and things, including a lot of things with Klingons in them.
And we don't have any idea what to expect on this. This is a big experiment all put together by Christine, who has done an amazing job getting all this together. Chime in there, Christine. Say hello.
Say goodnight, Gracie.
Okay. All right. So anyway, today we're gathered together here at CAGCon 2020, the home invasion, and our original plan was to talk about A Good Day to Die, but we'll see what happens. So
if Keith could try and remember his pitch to his publisher and give us that.
Okay, so a little background. A Good Day to Die was the result of me creating the crew of the IKS Gorkon in a previous book, a Next Generation novel that came out in 2001 called Diplomatic Implausibility, which was Gorkon's first mission as Federation ambassador to the Klingon Empire following the Deep Space Nine phenomenon. And so I put him on a Klingon ship, and I basically, what Diplomatic Implausibility was a weird Klingon inversion of the Star Trek cliche of the annoying diplomat who comes on board and drives everybody on the crew crazy, except our POV character is actually the annoying diplomat. It's Worf, and he's on a Klingon ship. I used a bunch of different characters who had appeared in various episodes of Next Generation and Deep Space Nine as part of the crew of the Gorkon. And I then used them again in a two-book series called The Brave and the Bold, where they teamed up with Picard's Enterprise to deal with the threat. And then Simon and Schuster gave me the go-ahead to do a series taking place on a Klingon ship. This was at a time when the Star Trek novel line was doing a lot of original series that were not necessarily based on one of the, at the time, five extant TV shows. They had done New Frontier by Peter David, which launched in 1997. And that was a huge success, and that led to other things like the Titan series, the Stargazer series, the Vanguard series, stuff like that. And I did the Gorkon. And what I pitched the first two books as was basically what we put on the back cover of the book, which is the IKS Gorkon's ongoing mission is to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, and conquer them for the greater glory of the Klingon Empire. And we wanted to put them in a situation specifically where they found a world that could conceivably be conquered and added to the Empire. But specifically for this storyline, I wanted, we always talk about how the Klingons are a warrior race, and in practical terms, you can't possibly have a warrior race any more than you can have a plumber race or, you know, You can't build an interstellar empire where everybody's a warrior. That's not practical. It's not possible. It had been made clear, particularly in places like Once More Under the Breach on Deep Space Nine and in Judgment on Enterprise, that the Klingons had a very rigid caste system, and the warriors were at the top of that class caste system, but they're still other people. So what I wanted to do was have the Klingons go up against a real warrior cult, like a much smaller but very... people who were completely dedicated to being warriors because of the way their world was, they could afford to be like that because they had plenty of natural resources. They didn't have a lot of technology. And so their lives were completely given over to just the warrior ethos and then having to confront them. So that's what that's about. That was the pitch. And then they, because of the weird subspace eddies around the planet, energy weapons don't work and scanners don't work. So all the Klingons have to work with are bladed weapons and such. So they fight against the Santara. They realize they probably could maybe conquer them eventually, but they are also worthy warriors. And so they challenge them to basically various martial contests. Whoever wins, if the Klingons win, the Santara will become part of the Klingon Empire. If the Santara win, the Klingons will go and leave them alone over the rest of the book.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that three out of your five challenges in that particular story we've actually done in the SCA.
That wouldn't surprise me.
The capture the flag is a woods battle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Everybody has a tournament. And believe it or not, the SCA has done boat battle.
I wanted to ask you about the Santara themselves. The impression I got from the book is they are a canine-like race.
Yeah, they're basically wolves. Sentient. Picture a sentient wolf with opposable thumbs, and you've got the Santara.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So where did this idea of, rather than just conquering the planet and taking over as we would expect Klingons to do, where did you come up with the idea of the contests?
Well, I mean, I wanted it's a fairly it's a fairly standard idea, and I wanted to play around particularly with the concepts of honor. One of the running themes, particularly in Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and on Enterprise for that matter, was the conflict between the ideals of Klingon honor versus the reality of everyday life in an interstellar empire. One of the more compelling ongoing storylines was Worf's constant conflict between the ideal Klingon that he tried to be as somebody who didn't actually live in the Empire versus the political realities of the Empire. The contests were there basically so there would be a basis for what happened in Book 2, which was called Honor Bound. Basically what happens is, and I'm spoiling the book, but the book came out in 2003, so I don't feel too bad about spoiling a 17-year-old book. The Gorkon actually loses. The Santara win 3 out of the 5 contests. So, and this is Clegg from the TNG episode of Matter of Honor, who was the second officer on the ship where Riker served as first officer as part of the exchange program. Clegg gives his word. The Klingon Empire will leave them alone, and they go off, only to find out that the general Talak, who's in charge of the fleet, says, no, get your ass back there and conquer them. The hell with this. We're the Klingon Empire. We'll beat whoever gets in our way, and that's that. And Clegg's feeling is he gave his word. Talak's feeling is they're just aliens anyway, and it doesn't matter. So the reason for the contest was to give a basis by which Clegg would give his word that he would leave them alone and then be in a position where he had to go back on his word or defend the Santara against the fleet. And then you wind up with Klingon fighting Klingon. I don't remember whose idea it was originally, whether it was mine or my editor's, but my editor, John Ordover, on those first two books, we had worked out the plot together. So some of the ideas came from me and some of them came from him. And 17 years later, I don't remember who came up with what necessarily. But one of the ideas was we wanted to take something that was established as in one episode of Deep Space Nine and never mentioned again, the Order of the Batleth, which seemed to be a fairly ceremonial thing that we saw in the Apocalypse Rising episode of Deep Space Nine. And what I thought would be, what John and I thought would be a cool thing to do is make it originally something along the lines of like the Knights Templar or something like that, where the original purpose of the Order was after Kalis's ascension, when he went off to, when he disappeared as was established in Rightful Heir. After that, the Order of the Batleth was formed to make sure that the word of Kalis was still followed in the absence of the actual Kalis to give it. So that was the original purpose. It sort of had fallen away from that. And one of the things we had Martok doing in the post-Dominion War Empire as one of his first acts as Chancellor was to restore the Order to its original function, that the purpose of the Order is to make sure that Kalos's teachings are still followed by the citizens of the Empire. And so what we have is, you know, people who are in the Order and people who are not in the Order, and people who don't believe in the Order and people who do believe it, and then there's, you know, Klingon versus Klingon, and much wackiness ensues.
So. You know, one thing that you don't talk about in the book that falls very neatly in this contest thing is by having a contest, and that's going to decide who dominates the planet, you don't destroy the culture that's on it, so that right. if the Klingons do take it over, the culture is still intact and wants to be part of the Empire rather than decimated, and the Klingons need to rebuild.
Right. Also, honestly, the story, while yes, the Klingons do tend to come in and conquer things and take over, that in and of itself doesn't make for an interesting novel. There needed to be something else to make it worth actually telling a novel about. You know, I mentioned the Gorkon is one of a fleet of ships, the Chancellor-class ships, that are sent out to explore a sector of space and find new worlds to conquer. And I mentioned other worlds that are conquered, but they're just mentioned in passing because those went smoothly. If things go smoothly, you don't want to read a novel about it. So,
you've got to have something at the end where somebody has to make a decision that's going to change their life. And I think you do that with Clegg, and well, he's defeated and he honors his word.
Yes.
So in the Next Generation episode where we first see Clegg, I really like this officer. He is really great. And I really also enjoyed the way that you built him up and extended his honor and making him a very likable character.
Thank you.
At the same time, he's having some difficulties within the Empire because of a surgery he had. And I was wondering where that all came from, where he got his arm, his right arm from his father. And it seemed to upset a lot of people.
I think you touched on that in Diplomatic Immunity, didn't you?
That was where that started. Yeah. The in Diplomatic Implausibility, he only has one arm, and tries to function with only one arm. By the end of the novel, he is willing to accept a transplant from his father. He is not willing to accept a prosthetic. That's a bridge too far for a lot of Klingons.
And his doctor kept pushing the prosthetic.
Yeah. Well, the notion partly grew out of, I thought it would be cool to build on what was established both in Ethics on Next Generation and in general on Deep Space Nine with Martok, that Klingon medicine is, you know, not the best. And what if we had a Klingon doctor who had actually studied medicine in the Federation and was trying to improve the state of Klingon medicine, and what kind of uphill battles she would have to fight? I had a lot of fun with Dr. Borak. I thought she was a wonderful character because I thought that was a cool thing to work on, and to develop, because you've got Martok several times. We saw him visiting the infirmary on Deep Space Nine because his own infirmary sucked. And so, with him now in charge of the Empire, I figured there would be a more of a willingness to deal with that, to open up Klingon medicine to being a bit less barbaric.
But it's still an uphill battle for her the whole way.
Yeah. But then that particular uphill battle makes up a running plot throughout all the books I've done with the Gorkon. The Diplomatic Implausibility, Brave and the Bold, the three IKS Gorkon books, and the Klingon Empire novel, A Burning House. In fact, a lot of it comes to a head in A Burning House, as one of the threads in that particular novel involves her attending a medical conference, which is something of a disaster.
One of the things that's interesting in your choice of characters is you picked out so many characters that we know and brought them aboard the Gorkon, like Worf's brother or is that a spoiler? The youth that he discovered on the planet there was a prisoner, you know.
Yeah.
All these guys. Right.
Basically, I did the same thing that Peter David did with New Frontier, which was to try to find some guest stars who people might enjoy seeing again.
See where they went?
Yeah. My first choice actually was Leskett, the pilot from Soldiers of the Empire, who was played by David Graff, who is quite possibly my favorite Klingon. I love Leskett. He's a spectacular smartass, and he's so much fun to write too. I loved working with him and writing him. He was, like I said, he was my first choice.
Yeah, I can see the interplay between him and I forget the chief engineer's name.
Correct.
They're always going at it, even though she's going after the second in command now of the Gorkon,
right,
for a while.
Yeah.
And then quits. And then
now, I am so glad, Keith, you brought up Leskett. And I'll tell you what, I could tell all the way through this book that he was your favorite Klingon. And his
he got to play with him.
Oh, yeah. And his snark was just perfect. I mean, I loved him in the episode, and then in the book, he just goes ballistic, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
He, like I said, he was my first choice. When I first had the idea of putting the crew together, Leskett, even before Clegg, it was like, okay, we got to have Leskett. And then who else? Clegg was my second choice. Like you, Jim, I loved him in A Matter of Honor and really thought he was a fascinating character. And Brian Thompson did such a good job with him. I really wanted to develop him further, particularly the relationship, the obviously tempestuous relationship he had with his father. And so that worked out nicely. But yeah, no, I love Leskett. I've always been partial to smartasses. It's why I like Whiting Quark also when I write Deep Space Nine material. So, yeah.
Great. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to ask or talk about?
I have a question. Keith, I met you a couple years ago at Florida Supercon.
Okay.
And I said the same thing to you, which I'm going to say now. A lot of your books would have made great Klingon episodes on Deep Space Nine and Star Trek, and it's a shame that we didn't get to see any more Klingon related stuff. They were really awesome, and I love your work.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I have a question, if I may come in. If I may.
Please.
Keith?
Yeah.
Were you at all scared of getting sued for plagiarism for taking things straight out of the Princess Bride and putting it in the book?
I'm sorry, I did not hear the entire question. I apologize. Could you repeat that?
Feedback, sorry.
I'm sorry. You have in, I think it's the first book, the whole bit where one of the contests is holding the rock for as long as you can.
Yeah.
You took that straight out of the Princess Bride.
Yeah, well, That was mainly because the character of Gorin was basically the Klingon that Andre the Giant would have played. So I kind of had to do that. It is not the first Princess Bride reference I have worked into a Star Trek novel. I'll just say that much. I wrote a Ferengi novel that was in Worlds of Deep Space Nine, Volume 3. And leave us say that I made use of the fact that the same actor played both Grand Nagus Zek and Vizzini.
And it was pretty important to this book that... Gorkon was his name again?
Gorin.
Gorin had to lose that particular contest for something that he was strong in.
Yes.
Because of the dilemma he presents to himself afterwards.
Yes. Yeah, Gorin has always gone through life being the biggest and the strongest, and it was very devastating to his worldview to not be the biggest and the strongest for once. One of my favorite lines in any Star Trek episode was in a second season episode called Peak Performance, where Picard says to Data, "It is possible to do everything right and still lose," which is one of the, you know, one of the most wonderful truisms I've ever heard, because it's, you know, yeah, you can do everything. It's one of the things that has gotten me through things like martial arts tournaments and stuff like that. Sometimes, you know, it just, there's always somebody better than you. There's always somebody stronger than you, and somebody's got to win. When somebody's got to win, which always means, therefore, that somebody's got to lose. And it's something I try to convey whenever I'm teaching karate to kids, is that, you know, if you're going to have a contest, most of you are going to lose. And it's a hard lesson to learn. And Goran needed to learn it because he'd never lost before. So.
Well, and that is much appreciated that you do teach that in this day and age where everybody gets a ribbon no matter what happens. So I think it is important for young people to learn that you're not always going to win and you're not always going to get a trophy. So,
but it's important to play.
So,
yeah.
Oh, yes. So anyone else have anything? Just jump on in.
Okay, I thought it was interesting that Torg got chosen for the hunt competition because he was pretty much introduced to us in Star Trek through a hunt. Talk.
Was that Talk?
Oh, Talk. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I figured I'd play with that since that was something he took to in the episode. You know.
Big time.
Yeah, so let's run with that and have him, you know, pursue it when he returns to the Empire and become a really good hunter. So yeah, of course he took to that very quickly.
In my mind, I had this concept of how the heck is he dragging this huge animal back to the camp all the way from where he finally took it down? That was a Herculean feat of itself.
Practice. Yeah.
He's a Klingon.
I have another question if I may ask. Yes. The Clag story that's in, I think it's Tales of the Vinian War, was not written by you.
Correct.
Did you, how much input did you have into that?
Okay, well, I edited the Dominion War anthology, so I had arguably all the input into it. Basically, in 2004, I put together the Tales of the Dominion War anthology, which I edited and which I gathered a bunch of people. I wanted to do an anthology that would show what the rest of the Star Trek universe was doing during the Dominion War. One of the stories that had to be in there, because I'd already established it in a couple other books, was the story of how Clegg lost his arm, because that was established as happening in the final days of the Dominion War. The thing is, I also wanted me personally to write the story of the fall of Beta Zed. I'm from New York City. I lived through September 11th here in town. And at the time, this was in 2003 when I put the anthology together, so it was only 2 years previous. It was, I needed to write the story of the fall of Beta Zed. That was kind of my personal 9/11 catharsis story. I think every writer had at least one of those, especially all those of us who live in New York, had one of those in the early days of the 21st century. So I really wanted to do that story. But I wanted the Clag story to be in there, so I asked Robert Greenberger if he would do the story of Clag. The only guidance I gave him was what was already established in the previous books, which was the story that Clag had told in Diplomatic Implausibility of how it happened. And I let Bob run with it from there, and I thought he did a great job. I was very pleased with the job he did on that. Bob was very flattered that I trusted him with in essence, my character. I mean, he isn't really my character, but that was my story for him. And I wanted, like I said, I needed to write the Beta Zed story, and I'm glad I did. Honestly, the story was called The Ceremony of Innocence is Drowned, which is the fall of Beta Zed from Waxana Troy's perspective. And I think it's one of the best stories I've written. So I have no regrets about making that choice. And like I said, Bob did a good job. So.
Okay, so here's a follow-up question. Who exaggerated the story more? Bob or Clag?
Oh, Clag, easily. God, he exaggerated every time he told it. More and more each time, you know.
See, guys, when you go to conventions, come up with stories, exaggerate them to entertain the crowds. Do it! Yes.
All right, floor's open. Anyone else?
Is there anything we can do to convince the current editor of the book to bring you back to write more?
If I knew, I'd have done it. I don't know. I don't know why the current leadership at Simon & Schuster doesn't want to hire me. I've tried. I've pitched things. And I mean, you know, you could write letters, I guess. But I don't know. I really don't. I wish I could have an answer for that. But Yeah, I don't know.
It's like,
meantime, I'm at the very least, I'm still writing about Star Trek for Tor.com. I'm currently rewatching Voyager. I've done rewatches of the original series, Next Gen and Deep Space Nine. I've been reviewing each of the new CBS All Access series as they come episodes as they come out. It is not a novel, but I do have a Star Trek project in the works that hasn't been announced yet. I'm waiting. There was supposed to be an announcement by now, but the pandemic kind of messed that up. But there will be an announcement soon of a Star Trek project that I am doing. And I'm also been talking with the current editor at IDW. There's nothing solid yet, but that could develop into some comic book work. We'll see. But I haven't given up the idea of writing more Star Trek fiction, but it's not going to happen with Simon and Schuster as long as the current editors are in charge, for whatever reason. And to be fair, this happens all the time. Every time there's a regime change especially in the tie-in line as large as Star Trek's, when a new editor comes in, there are some writers who suddenly have no work, and there are some writers who suddenly have more work. And there hasn't been a change at Simon and Schuster since 2009 or 2008. Yeah, no, 2009. It's been the same two editors in charge since then for 11 years now. So, you know, it would probably take another regime change for me to be considered again.
Okay. So we need to write letters. Get those letters going.
Yeah, check SimonAndSchuster.com, see if things turn out. I don't know what kind of feedback things they have there. I haven't really investigated it, but I've got plenty to keep me busy right now anyway.
Well, I'll tell you what, of all the authors, and this is not to say that Mike Friedman and Dayton Ward and David Mack and doesn't do a great job with Klingons, but when I read Klingon books you have written, they always tend to float to the top as my favorite ones. You seem to know Klingons very well. Now, I am wondering why. What is your edge? At least the edge that exists in my mind.
I mean, my interest in Klingons first came about from growing. I grew up in New York City in the 1970s, watching Star Trek reruns on a local independent station, which aired it every weeknight at 6 p.m. My parents watched it with me. My parents watched the original series in first run in the 60s. I watched it in reruns in the 70s on Channel 11 in New York every night at 6. We'd watch Star Trek at 6, and then we'd eat dinner at 7. That was our routine. And my interest in Klingons mostly derived initially from the characters of Kang and Kor, especially Kang. Kor too, but Kang in particular. Day of the Dove was always one of my favorite episodes because Kang was a worthy foe. He was Kirk's equal in so many ways, and that made him a very respectable character. Moving forward, I've always had an interest in the martial arts. I didn't actually start training in the martial arts until I turned 35 in 2004. But even before that, I was always interested in it, which led me to doing it in the first place. So the idea, and I've always been a big fan of samurai movies, and I've always been a big fan of you know, warrior ethoses and stuff like that. So the interest has always been there. And I really liked the characters. The character I gravitated to on Next Generation when it first aired in 1987 was Worf. It's just a culture that has fascinated me since I first saw Kang in Day of the Dove. And it never waned, you know.
Anyone else want to chime in with a question?
One of the things,
John, you got
one
any?
Of the things that that is being presented this weekend, and I'm not sure where you would find it on here, but Jim or John could probably tell you. I did a reading from A Burning House, which is available to people, to you guys here at the convention this weekend. A Burning House was tremendous fun to write. We did that. The IKS Gorkon series was not as successful as we had hoped in terms of sales. The first two books did fine. The third book did not. And we were trying to figure out a way to get more interest in the series. And so we rebranded it as Klingon Empire. And we did A Burning House in 2008. The book did fine. But it did better than Enemy Territory did, but not enough to do more books. And then we had editorial regime change and so on. But what I wanted to do, particularly in A Burning House, was show what I mentioned before about how, you know, it's not really a warrior culture. It's merely a culture in which the warriors are at the top of the class heap, as it were. What is life like for people who aren't in the military and who aren't in politics? Because that's really 90% of what we've seen on screen has been Klingon military and Klingon politicians, most of whom are former military. So I wanted to show a Klingon opera house. I wanted to show a Klingon farm. I wanted to show a Klingon slum. Just expand out showing daily life in the Empire. The chapter that I read for this convention was one of my favorite things, which was in addition to being a fan of Klingons, I am also an Italian American and therefore have a great appreciation of food and in particular of the importance of the dinner table conversation. And the character of Tabona is sort of the matriarch of this large farming family on one of the Klingon colony worlds. And I've got a bunch of people from the Gorkon, a couple of the ground troops who go there to spend their leave while the ship is being repaired. And, you know, I wanted to show the differing, like, still very obviously Klingons, but different philosophies because of their particular station in life and their worldview. So I hope you guys will check that out if you haven't already. I'm not sure where you would find it on here.
But in the videos section.
In the video section? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. We actually
hashtag videos down below.
I loved it. As I was saying earlier, so you should read more for us.
you're reading online, aren't you, during the pandemic?
Yes. I have a YouTube channel that I created called Crad COVID Readings. There's a link to it on my website at decandido.net. And I have done I've done 29 different stories of mine. I'm mostly just reading short fiction. I'm probably going to put, once this convention is over, I'm probably going to put the A Burning House thing on there as a sort of a special thing. But I read, the only Klingon thing I have read so far is my short story in Tales from the Captain's Table, which is a 2005 anthology I put together. I did a Clag story for that called Lodnipu Vapu G, which is Brothers and Fathers. It's a Clag story. And I read that as part of it. I've also read, I think, two other Star Trek works so far. I read a bit from one of the Corps of Engineers novellas, and I read my Voyager short story, Letting Go, which was...
Hard to let go?
I'm sorry? What was that, John?
Hard to let go?
No, Letting Go.
No. But it doing was about, that was hard to let go.
Well, yes. It was what I wanted to do for that was... Letting Go was for the anthology Distant Shores, which was done for Voyager's 10th anniversary in 2005. And I wanted to do a story that focused on the people left behind, on, you know, Janeway's boyfriend and Paris's father and so on. Tuvok's wife and kids. Basically all the people, Samantha Wildman's husband. All the people who all they knew was Voyager disappeared and they didn't know what happened to them. So it focused on them. And I read that one as well. I'm probably very soon, I want to read my Deep Space Nine story from the Prophecy and Change anthology, which was called Broken Oaths, which is a follow-up to the Hippocratic Oath episode. That was an episode in which Bashir and O'Brien had a major disagreement over how to treat some Jem'Hadar. And the episode ended with the two of them kind of like upset with each other, and they never resolved it. Like by the time we saw them together again, they were back to playing darts together, and we never saw how they resolved the issue in their friendship. So I wrote the story to sort of explain how they wound up back to being, you know, bros again. And I'm probably going to be reading that one fairly soon. But I've been enjoying, and I've been reading a lot of my other, I've been trying to like do a wide range of fiction of mine that I've been reading, from my original work to my other tie-in work. Including some of my urban fantasy stories, some of my high fantasy police procedural stories, various standalone short stories that I've written, some science fiction stories, all kinds of stuff. So you should check it out. Again, it's Crad COVID Readings. You can find it on YouTube. You can subscribe to the channel so you'll get alerts when I put it. I've gotten into the pattern of putting one up every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So this last week I did in three parts. I did a longer story of mine called "The Ballad of Big Charlie," which is in Jonathan Mayberry's shared world vampire anthology called V-Wars. And it's a story about a politician from the Bronx who announces that he is a vampire. The theme of the anthology is a bunch of different people contract a virus that turns them into a vampire. And the Bronx district attorney announces that he has it, and it shows how it affects his political career going forward. So that was a very long-winded answer to the question. Sorry.
I'm going to place your YouTube channel in the author's table.
So thank you. Thank you.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry. I know you're busy. I just have one more question, if I may.
Of course. Please.
We got time.
In the Clagg books, at the end, in the appendices, you referenced various actors who you had seen in various productions that inspired different characters in the books.
Yes.
My question is, what other actors are there that you thought should have been maybe cast as Klingons, but didn't for whatever reason? And why do you think Toshiro Mifune would have done a great job?
Oh, God. Yeah, well, first of all, Toshiro Mifune would have done a great job because he was Toshiro fucking Mifune. Pardon my language. Toshiro Mifune could have played pretty much anybody he was asked to. But yes, he would have made a dandy Klingon. Let's see. Who could play a Klingon who has not yet?
Yeah, I mean...
You know who I always thought would make a great Klingon? And I was kind of hoping that if there were more bad robot movies that they would hire him to play... either Kang or Kang really is Vincent D'Onofrio. He's like Mifune. He's one of those actors who can pretty much do anything, and he's got the physicality to do a really good Klingon, I would think. I think Vincent D'Onofrio would definitely make a good Klingon. Let's see, who else? Mike Coulter, who played Luke Cage, and is currently on Evil. I think he would make a really good Klingon. I think one that I mentioned in the book, the character of Lokor on the Gorkon was basically the Klingon that Keith Hamilton Cobb would have played. He played the Nietzschean on Andromeda back in the day. I met him once, actually. He was a really, meeting him in person made it more obvious that he would have made a good Klingon. Okay, here's an odd one. Specifically for a character like Tabona, who was a matriarch of a large Klingon family, CCH Pounder. I could definitely see her as an elderly Klingon.
My own, when I play Kroath in at conventions and all, my two main inspirations are actually John Rhys Davies and Jackie Gleason.
Huh. I can definitely see John Rhys Davies as a Klingon. Yes, that would work.
I can see John Rhys Davies as anything.
Pretty much, yeah. He's another one who can do whatever you put in front of him. But yeah, he could definitely do that. Actually, I'm thinking, I've been watching Gargoyles on Disney Plus, and John Rhys Davies had a recurring role there as Macbeth, who is a very Klingon-y character in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think of his role as Rodrigo in Shogun. It's like, oh, that's Klingon.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that would work.
Wow.
I was so grateful when Enterprise did Affliction and Divergence and they hired James Avery to play a Klingon, because he was somebody I've been saying for years should have played a Klingon, and they finally cast him.
I understand he was up for Worf. He almost got Worf. He was the second choice.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So, Keith, as far as the writing process that you use...
I usually go left to right.
Okay, there we go.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Aspiring writer myself.
Now. Nah, he's frozen on my screen.
Yeah. Again, so.
He's frozen.
My God, they trapped him in carbonite. There he is. You, okay.
Do you plot everything out? Or do you write by the seat of your pants, or do you have a combination of
that? I am very much a plotter. Now, an important caveat to this is when you're writing tie-in fiction like Star Trek fiction, you're not allowed to be a pantser. You have to plot first, because before you ever start writing your story or your novel or your comic book, you have to write the plot out and submit that to CBS licensing for approval. So it's really not allowed to write by the seat of your pants, because you can't write something that hasn't, where the plot hasn't already been approved first. I got my start writing tie-in fiction, so that became pretty much ingrained in my head. Having said that, I prefer that way. I don't like if I like to know where I'm going when I'm writing something. Now, okay. In addition to that, which relates specifically to the Gorkon books, is every once in a while when you're writing, something occurs to you, and what you have to do then is run it by your editor. In particular, and this is a spoiler for Honor Bound, in Honor Bound, Cornyn, the character of Cornyn, dies. That was not part of the outline. I had no intention of killing Cornyn. In fact, I had no intention of killing Cornyn until I was literally in the middle of writing his death scene. I'm writing, and all of a sudden, like, the scene took over my brain, and I find my, oh, crap, he's got to die. It's like, there was, I couldn't do anything else there. So I finished the scene, and then I called my editor, and I said, Marco, there is a slight change to the outline. Can you run this by Paula Block, who is the person who did the approvals at the time, and make sure she's okay with it? Especially since, while he was only in one episode, Cornyn is still technically a screen character, and we're not allowed to kill him off without, you know, permission. So I kept writing anyway, and like hoping that Paula would let me get away with it. And she was like, yeah, fine, don't worry about it. So so it all worked out in the end. So yeah, every once in a while that will happen. And there have been other cases where I've had to make changes to the outline because of how the story actually developed. In my own fiction, it doesn't matter. I just go ahead and do it. In tie-in fiction, then you've got to run it by your editor, who may sometimes have to run it by licensing to get that approved before you can implement that actual change. So, but yes, I much okay. prefer to know where I'm going. You know, it's to my mind, it's the equivalent of when you're driving somewhere. You put the address in Google Maps, and you're given the route. And you may wind up deviating from that route because you hit a traffic jam, or there's an accident, or there's construction. But at the very least, you started knowing what your destination is going to be and a vague idea of how you're going to get there. So,
any other questions from the audience?
I have one. One other, Keith. Yes. Question for you: have there been any talks or plans on probably putting the books on an audio adaptation format? Because I know there was a petition going on, I saw maybe about a month ago, that they want to put on audio Andrew Robinson's book, A Stitch of Time. I was wondering if there was any talks or maybe future plans of probably maybe putting one of the books on audio.
I have no idea. That's even if I was still involved in writing for Simon & Schuster, I probably wouldn't know anything about that, because that happens with a separate division. Right now, they're committed to doing audios of all the new books. I don't know if there are any plans to do the backlist, any of the backlist. Stitch in Time would be an obvious choice because it's an autobiographical Garrick novel by the guy who played Garrick, and getting Robinson to read it is a no-brainer, it would seem. But also, I don't know what the logistics of that would be, and that would be handled by Simon & Schuster's audio department, and I have no idea what their thoughts are on the matter. I don't know how well the Star Trek audios sell. There may not be enough of a market to justify doing it for a 17-year-old book. But again, I wouldn't know. I think if the Stitch in Time thing happens, then it may lead to more. We'll see. But the real answer is I have no crapping clue.
I can tell you as an audiobook listener, when I was buying Star Trek audiobooks, the thing that really frustrated me was that they were all abridged.
Yeah. That's a byproduct of the time, because the audios were only available on cassette tapes. So the only way to do an unabridged audio is to have it have like 14 cassette tapes, which is a pain in the patooties to package and put together and everything else. Now, with everything electronic, there's no reason to abridge it. But at the time, it was the only practical way to create it, because there were unabridged audios of some in the world. But for something to be a mass market success, you know, most of the unabridged audios were things like classic literature that would like be sold to libraries and stuff like that.
And Tolkien.
The Simon & Schuster couldn't really justify the price point that they would need to sell it at if there's like 10 cassettes. Again, now it's less of an issue. So now they're unabridged, and that's standard operating procedure. But that didn't happen until the primary delivery system for audiobooks was an electronic file rather than piece of physical media. So
I always thought it was.
Right. Okay, well, that makes sense.
I always thought it was that when truck drivers discovered audiobooks, and the fact that they had the time to keep switching the tapes didn't matter anymore. It's just they needed something to keep their mind alert for those 24-hour trips.
Well, that's always been one of the primary markets for the two primary markets for audio are people who are in their cars a lot and people who have visual impairments. Yeah. So
that's where a lot of the came from was the people who had the visual impairments.
Yeah. Yeah.
Books on tape, I think.
Yeah. I yelled at Dayton one time because one of his books was abridged, and I told him, don't let him do that anymore.
Yeah, it's really not in our control at all.
And that's exactly what he sent back to me. He said, you know, it's not anything. I don't have any control over that. That's interesting that, you know, I had never thought about the cassette thing. And I had some books on audio cassette. So are there any other questions from the gallery?
One last thing. Hey, Keith, what are you working on now?
I have
plug.
Yes, I have two collaborative novels that are coming out this year. One will be out very soon. It's called To Hell and Regroup, which I wrote with David Sherman. It's actually the third book in a trilogy. Excuse me, third book. Let me put it this way: if you liked A Good Day to Die, you'll probably like this trilogy too. It's called The 18th Race. The first book was called In All Directions. The second book was called Issue in Doubt. Those are both written by David Solo. I edited those two books when they were first published. David is quite elderly at this point and has been having some health issues and wasn't able to finish the book himself. So I took the partial manuscript and the notes that he had put together for the book and with his blessing and with his consultation, finished the book for him. So it's basically a it's very much a collaboration between the two of us, but it's also almost entirely in David's style. This is very much David's book that I'm just finishing for him. Like with my media tie-in work, this is a case where I'm a writer for hire who's working in someone else's universe. It just happens to be a original one instead of one owned by a corporation. Again, if you enjoyed the Klingon books, you will probably enjoy this trilogy. And another connection to Klingons, Dayton Ward actually, Dayton Ward's like David Sherman, is an ex-Marine, and he read over the manuscript. He vetted it also, just so we had another set of eyes who knows military protocol going over it. It's about an alien invasion of a colony world in the near future. It's basically, you know, Marines in space, and also the Army and Navy in space too, fighting against these rather brutal aliens. And that'll be out from eSpec Books very shortly. Another collaboration I did with Dr. Munish K. Batra, who's a surgeon and humanitarian. He and I have been collaborating on a couple things, and our first book together is called Animal. It's a serial killer novel. It's much different from my usual thing. That'll be out from Wordfire Press at the end of this year. It's about a serial killer who targets people who harm animals. I am also working on the next two books in my two fantasy series. The Adventures of Brom Gold, which is an urban fantasy that takes place in my hometown of the Bronx. It's about a nice Jewish boy from the Bronx who hunts monsters for a living. The first book came out last year called The Furnace Sealed. The second book, which is tentatively titled Feet of Clay, feet spelled F-E-A-T, will be out hopefully later this year. I'm working on that now. I am also working on the next Precinct novel, which is my fantasy police procedural series. The sixth novel in that series, which is called Phoenix Precinct, will be out either by the end of this year or the beginning of next year, depending on when I get it finished. and I've got some short stories coming out this year. I'm going to be in the third Pangea shared world anthology that Michael Jan Friedman edited for Crazy 8 Press. I've got a story in Mary Fan's Badass Moms anthology, also from Crazy 8 Press, this summer. And a bunch of other things. Oh, and a graphic novel that adaptation. I adapted Gregory Wilson's science fiction novel into two graphic novels called Icarus and Jelinek, which will be out very soon from Athis Arts. And I think that's everything. Oh, and of course, twice a week on Tor.com, I am doing my Star Trek Voyager rewatch. If you go to Tor.com, you can find my rewatches, as I said, of the original series, which also included the animated series and all the original series movies, my Next Generation rewatch, my Deep Space Nine rewatch, my reviews of each episode of Discovery, Short Treks, and Picard as they have come out, and I'm currently rewatching Voyager, and it's pretty likely, just because I've covered everything else, that I'll do a rewatch of Enterprise when I'm done with Voyager. That's still a year and a half in advance. We'll cross that bridge when we burn it. But right now I'm in the home stretch of the second season of Voyager. This past Thursday, God, what went up? Was it Innocence? No, it was The Thaw, which is the one with Michael McKean as the creepy clown. So I'm going to be finishing the second season this month and moving on to the third season. So, and I've written other things for Tor.com as well. I do a lot of pop culture commentary and such.
Listening to you talk about all the projects that you're currently working on, my God, I'd like to see how you've got your brain segmented so much that you can work on so many different projects and not get them blurring into each other.
Hasn't happened yet.
I think it's great.
Hopefully that's it won't why happen. He plots that could get very out. Ugly if I start melding worlds like that.
All right. So I think we're going to go ahead and start wrapping this up. I want to tell Keith, thank you very much for joining us. And you'll be on another panel a couple hours from now. Be watching for that. And I think, I'm pretty sure Dayton Ward will be joining you on that panel. And that'll be so neat to have you two guys bouncing back and forth with each other.
We might even stay on topic, but I wouldn't count on it.
Michael Bay is also on that panel, and he's sitting in here.
Excellent. And that'll be a fun one.
Yes, hello, Ruby. Folks. Looking forward to talking with everyone.
Hopefully you'll get a word in.
Yes. Yeah. I was on a panel a couple of years ago with Keith and John Halverson, and between me and Keith, we couldn't get John get a word in edgewise.
That was a great panel. I was there. That was the con that I stalked Keith all for like 3 days.
Oh, Ozfest?
Yeah, I was playing on culture panel.
Yeah.
Right.
That was fun. Yes, it was. So, we're going to wrap this up now. For Bound by Honor, I am Jim.
And I am Jorn.
And Keith, if you join us on the count of three for a couple.
And I'm Keith DeCandido. Sorry. Yes. Missed my cue.
Yes. On three, we'll John, Keith, and I will do a kapla, and anybody else you can join in if you like. Here we go. On three, you got to get your mics on. Okay. All right, here we go. On three, two, one, kapla. So long, everybody.
Thank you, Keith. You're again a wonderful guest.
Thank you.
We'll see you again.
Yes. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!